Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 8th, 2003. Today's session is entitled The Fertility Contest. Session 2 of God in the Highest Heavens, God Wrestling in the Mud. A Bible study presented by Jonathan Preuss, number PRJ 2003-02. Let's listen in.
Dear gracious God, we thank you for a new day. And for all the possibilities that lie before us at this wonderful place. Lord, we pray you guide each of us through the day and bring us to just the things that we need. We thank you for this Sabbath week, this Sabbath day, this time at Holden. And we thank you for these wonderful stories that bring something of your ways down to us through all these millennia, and in which we see shadows of the glories of Christ that are to come. Bless our study today and teach us through your Spirit. In Jesus' name, amen. If I don't talk loud enough or clear enough or slow enough or whatever, let me know, will you? Do something. Flap your ears or something. And I will try to do a little better than that. Yesterday, just as we reached 10 o'clock, somebody led us right to the beginning of session 3, which I mistook for session 2. So we stopped right there without clearly making the connection between the last part of the lesson, the part about the binding of Isaac, to the theme, God in heaven, God in the mud. Well, I think we did kind of hint at it, but let me just draw it out. God spoke to Abraham from on high in a sovereign way to make great promises to Abraham of a land, a nation, a multitudinous offspring, and a seed through whom all peoples would be blessed. And later added that this promise is to be fulfilled through Isaac. And then God spoke just as sovereignly to Abraham and said, now go sacrifice Isaac. It's this terrible contradiction. But at the point where God gets personally involved in the wood and in the binding, that happens prophetically. We saw how Isaac carried on himself the wood on which he was to be sacrificed, which we could see points forward to a cross that's going to be carried by the Lamb of God, which God will provide for the sacrifice, as Abraham said. So the connection between God in heaven and God and mud and the blood and mud, the rough stuff of earth, comes in prophetically, I think, in this story. It foreshadows the entering of God into the darkest human experience in Christ's suffering and death.
John, one of the things that intrigued me about the story is that Isaac lays there passively. And I try and think about it. He's got to be old enough to carry the wood, so he's not an infant.
Yep.
And for a young person, for argument's sake, 12, 14, 15, 16 years old, to lay there passively and be bound is really, I can't conceive of one of my children laying there passively. it's a real interesting piece of the story. What do you make of that?
We did talk about that after Isaac asked the question, where is the lamb? Here's the wood, here's the fire, but where's the lamb, Father? And Abraham says, God will provide the lamb for the sacrifice, my son. And they went on together. And it seems that Isaac has an inkling that something is a little bit haywire. It's scary. He leaves out the cleaver when he mentions the things that we have. So, in a way, I saw a connection between Jesus walking in the will of the Father. No matter where it goes, that's what he's going to do. There's an old midrash about that. We raised the question whether they told Sarah what happened on their camping trip. And there's an old Jewish midrash in which Sarah sees on Isaac's wrist the rope burns, which suggests he didn't just lie there passively, or else Abraham tied him really tight. And when she sees that, she turns away from Abraham and never speaks another word to him the rest of her life. In fact, she dies not very long afterwards. Now that's a midrash, expansion of the story, so it's not in the text. But what is in the text is the very next thing that happens is Sarah dies. And Abraham and Sarah are sojourning in Canaan, which is the land that's promised to Abraham, but he doesn't own any of it yet. But he now negotiates to buy a cave in which to bury Sarah, and then he will have something of that land. And he's got his eye on a certain cave. Although he's not a citizen there, he probably doesn't even have a green card. He's going to own some land there if he can. That's a good story. Let's just look at that story. Chapter 23. And Sarah's life was 127 years, the years of Sarah's life. And Sarah died in Kiriath Arba, which is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham came to mourn Sarah and to keen for her. And Abraham rose from before his dead, and he spoke to the Hittites, saying, I am a sojourning settler with you. Grant me a burial holding with you, and let me bury my dead now before me. And listen to the formality and the politeness with which this transaction moves forward. And the Hittites answered Abraham, saying, Pray, hear us, my Lord. You are a prince of God among us. In the pick of our graves, bury your dead. No man among us will deny you his grave for burying your dead. And Abraham rose and bowed to the folk of the land, to the Hittites. And he spoke with them, saying, If you have it in your hearts that I should bury my dead now before me, hear me, entreat for me Ephron, son of Zohar, and let him grant me the cave of Machpelah that belongs to him, which is at the far end of his field, which suggests it's kind of at the border line of their territory. At the full price, let him grant it to me in your midst as a burial holding. He wants to pay this price. And Ephron was sitting in the midst of the Hittites, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the Hittites, all the assembled in the gate of his town, the place where business is transacted, saying, Pray, my Lord, hear me. The field I grant you, and the cave that is in it, I grant it to you in full view of my kinfolk. I grant it to you, bury your dead. And Abraham bowed before the folk of the land. And he spoke to Ephron in the hearing of the folk of the land, saying, If you would but hear me, I give the price of the field. Take it from me, and let me bury my dead there. And Ephron answered Abraham, saying, Pray, my Lord, hear me. Land for 400 silver shekels between me and you. What does it come to? Go bury your dead. And Abraham listened to Ephron. And Abraham weighed out to Ephron the silver that he spoke of in hearing of the Hittites, 400 silver shekels at the merchant's tried weight. And Ephron's field at Machpelah by Mamre, the field and the cave that was in it, and every tree in the field within its boundaries all around passed over to Abraham as a possession. This is the word possession is the first occurrence of the word related to the word to buy. In the full view of the Hittites, all the assembled in the gate of his town. And then Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of Machpelah, field by Mamre, which is Hebron in the land of Canaan. And the field and the cave that was in it passed over to Abraham as a burial holding from the Hittites. Now, if that sounds repetitious, this is legal language. You ever look at a contract? You know, it just goes on and on and on. It seems to say everything much more than it needs to be said, but that's the way legal documents are. This is full of legal language from documents of that time have been uncovered. The language, the words that are used are of a serious legal transaction taking place in the place where these happen, at the gate, where, and you don't need paper contracts in those days. What do you need? You need witnesses. And all the Hittites are mentioned there. Everybody's there. Everybody knows Ephron. They know Abraham. They know Sarah. And so everyone knows whose cave that is. And that cave will reappear in the stories after this. So with elaborate politeness, the Hittites take Abraham to the cleaners. This is the way business goes, isn't it? He pays much more than the field is worth. He didn't even ask for the field. He only wanted the cave, but Ephron sells him the field as well. And Abraham doesn't complain. This is Abraham, you know. He just weighs out the money. This shows his really old story, because there were not coins as such. They were probably little chunks of silver that had to be weighed to give. The word shekel is a weight. It's not a denomination of a currency. He doesn't complain. The owner of the cave mentioned just offhandedly, oh, well, what's 200 silver shekels between you? You know? And Abraham just gives it to him. So Abraham now owns a little piece of the promised land. And it took a death, and it took a costly payment of the life of his wife, and then a good sum of money beyond that to make this happen. So the whole land God has promised to Abraham, you might say, why should he have to pay for it? But on the other hand, he does now have a legal toehold in that land, a kind of a mustard seed, you could say, of the fulfillment of God's promise. Well, Isaac doesn't have a mother, but Abraham determines that he's going to have a wife. And he makes his steward take an oath not to take a wife for him in these parts. He doesn't want the local Hittite women in his family. He wants them from his kinfolk back in Mesopotamia. Chapter 24. We won't read all of this, but just a little start. Abraham was old, advanced in years. Typical Hebrew, you got to say it twice to show that it really was true. And the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. And Abraham said to his servant, elder of his household, who ruled over all things that were his, put your hand, pray, under my thigh, which is probably a euphemism for his private parts, and maybe also a symbol of the procreation that is to happen through his son and the woman that he will marry. I make you swear by the Lord, God of the heavens and God of the earth, God above and God of the earth, as our theme has it, that you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanite in whose midst I dwell, but to my land and to my birthplace you shall go. You shall take a wife for my son, for Isaac. And the servant said to him, perhaps the woman will not want to come after me to this land. Shall I indeed bring your son back to the land you left? And Abraham said to him, watch yourself, lest you bring my son back there. The Lord God of the heavens, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my birthplace, who spoke to me and who swore to me, saying, to your seed I will give this land. He shall send his messenger before you, and you shall take a wife for my son from there. And if the woman should not want to go after you, you shall be clear of this vow of mine. Only my son you must not bring back there. So it's important to him that Isaac stays right there in the promised land. Although he has to make a trip down to Egypt, as Abraham does too, and as the whole family of the nation does later on. And as Jesus does finally, after his birth. And the servant put his hand under Abraham's thigh, and he swore to him concerning his thing. He took 10 camels with all the bounty of his master in his hand. That would be a kind of dowry that he would bring, gifts for the bride, perhaps for her family. And off he goes to Mesopotamia. There he goes to a well. When you see somebody going to a well and the girls come out, you know something's going to happen. What's going to happen?
They're going to meet a guy.
They're going to meet a guy. There's going to be a wedding. That happens repeatedly in the Old Testament. And I think there are echoes of that when Jesus meets in the Gospel of John the Samaritan woman at the well. You know, especially since in the second chapter of John, Jesus goes to a wedding at Cana. And it's only the fourth chapter where he meets the Samaritan woman. And what happens there? They run out of wine, and Jesus fulfills the role of the bridegroom by providing the wine. And is saying in a kind of a veiled way, this is God coming to marry God's bride, the people of Israel. And when he meets the Samaritan woman, I think there's also a suggestion that that bride includes also the Samaritans. That seems to be an issue in the Gospel of John. There are things in there about Samaritans that you don't see. There is in the parable of the Good Samaritan something that might be connected to that idea too. And in Luke, when Jesus sends out the disciples, or he tells them they're going to go, you shall be my witnesses, he says, it's declarative, it's not a command, in Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth. So Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria are kind of bunched together, and then the ends of the earth is everything else. Well, that's a little bit off the topic, but not completely, because I think all this Old Testament stuff has got its fingers, its streams flow down into the New Testament and come out in new ways there. Now, this woman that the servant of Abraham meets, what kind of a lady is she? He decides to make a fleece, you know, like Gideon's fleece, before the Lord, to find out which girl he's supposed to choose. What does he say? Chapter 24, verse 14. Let it be that the young woman to whom I say, pray, tip down your jug that I may drink. If she says, drink, and your camels too, I shall water. What does that mean? That means she's a go-getter, because to water a camel after a journey across the desert, they have large tanks, and their tanks are empty when they get there. So she's going to be dipping with her one jug a lot of water, and it's going to be a lot of work. So if she's that kind of woman, that's what Isaac needs. Maybe he's thinking a little bit, but Isaac is kind of passive, so he needs a wife to kind of take charge. Well, he gets one. Because he had barely finished speaking when, look, Rebecca was coming out, who was born of Bethuel, son of Milcah. This is a aside to the reader. Son of Milcah, wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother, with her jug on her shoulder. And the young woman was very comely to look at. A virgin, no man had known her. And she came down to the spring and filled her jug and came back up. And the servant ran toward her and said, pray, let me sip a bit of water from your jug. Of course, he's really thirsty, but his politeness, you know, just a little sip is all I need. And she said, drink, my lord. And she hurried and lowered her jug onto her hand and let him drink. And she let him drink his fill and said, for your camels too, I shall draw water, until they drink their fill. And she hurried and emptied her jug into the trough, and she ran again to the well to draw water, and drew water for all his camels. There's 10 camels, 10 big camels. I don't know, how big is a tank on a camel? At least as much as a Volkswagen. 100 gallons. Wow. And the man was staring at her, keeping silent to know whether the Lord had granted success to his journey. And it happened, when the camels had drunk their fill, that the man took a gold nose ring, a bekah in weight, and 2 bracelets for her arms, 10 gold shekels in weight. And he said, "Whose daughter are you?" I think he means that he gave them to her, though it doesn't say that, literally, because she's wearing them when they get home. "Tell me, pray, is there room in your father's house for us to spend the night?" She said, "I'm the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor. And she said, "We got lots of feed and room." And the man did obeisance and bowed to the Lord. And he said, "Blessed be the Lord, God of my master Abraham, who has not left off his steadfast kindness toward my master me on this journey the Lord led to the house of my master's kinsman." Just the place I was supposed to go. Well, her brother Laban speaks for the family. And the servant of Abraham tells the story of how he had laid this fleece before the Lord and how it came out. And Laban concludes, "Well, this is a God thing. What can we do? We have to give her to your master's son." And Rebecca is consulted. This is not always the case. "Will you go with this man?" They want to keep her for a while, you know, and have feasting and celebrating and so forth before they send her off. But he says, no, I found the one that I'm supposed to find. We've got to go right now. Also, he's probably thinking his father is old, or his master is old, and he doesn't want to wait too long. So they ask Rebecca, "Will you go with him?" And this is in chapter 24, verse 57. "Let us call the young woman and ask for her answer." This is rather unusual, but it maybe tells you something about Rebecca. She's not a girl that you just say go and she just goes. She's one you have to consult. And they ask, "Will you go with this man?" And she said, "I will." So the wedding service takes place over there without the groom present. She's already said her I do's before she goes. And when she gets there, there's nothing said. Isaac sees her, and she puts her veil over her face, kind of coyly, I think. And he comes and takes her into his mother's tent. No ceremony needed at that point. It's all taking place back there in her home place. But she sent off, I should mention, she sent off with her family, from her family with a blessing, with her nurse. "Our sister, become hence myriads teeming," which is a kind of a literal translation of the Hebrew. What does it mean? What have you got there in your translations? In verse 60. 24:60.
"Once has become thousands of myriads."
Okay. What does that mean?
Have lots of babies.
Have lots of babies, and let them have lots of babies too. Yeah. "May your seed take hold of the gate of its foes." This kind of echoes, doesn't it? God's promise to Abraham. Kind of an interesting coincidence. And Rebecca rose with her young women. She had servants. And they mounted the camels and went after the man. And they went off. And when they arrived, there's the long journey just goes like that. And she said to the servant, 65, "Who is that man walking through the field toward us?" And the servant said, "He is my master." And she took her veil and covered her face. And the servant recounted to Isaac all the things he had done, and Isaac brought her into the tent of Sarah, his mother, and took Rebekah as his wife. And he loved her, and Isaac was consoled after his mother's death. What's the symbolism of taking her into Sarah's tent?
Is it the issue
that any future offspring would be children of promise as well?
I think it's part of that promise. There's a new matriarch. And she really does become the matriarch. She's the strong figure in that household from that time on. She's the one who kind of makes things happen. And Isaac is rather passive.
John, if you go back to verse 57, where they ask Rebecca,
yeah,
if she'll go. That wasn't typical in the culture.
No, it wasn't.
Does this in any way suggest that she might have been a person, even a young person, with an extraordinary degree of power or respect or responsibility, and not just a normal cute girl?
Yeah. She was beautiful, but that wasn't the whole story. There was a lot more to her. Yeah.
And they gave her gold before she agreed to marry.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what customs were back then, but for example, I know in the Middle East and India today, you only get the gold after you agree to marry. Mm. And
well, it does. She accepted it.
Which is that? I mean,
she accepted it.
That
it suggests that she's whatever this guy is up to. She's along. She's with it. She'll go with it. At least, I think that's what it suggests. Yeah.
Abraham made the agreement and sent his servant to find her. But when they come back, we don't hear about Abraham at all.
No, we don't. There's a little interlude in chapter 25, the beginning. He gets, he takes another wife. But whether the chronology of this is a little uncertain, you know, you don't really know. Was this supposed to have happened after Isaac came back and he saw how happy he was with his wife? So Abraham decides. Abraham has already said long ago that, you know, he's too old to have children, and so is Sarah, but then he has a whole bunch more. So you wonder if this is something that's happened earlier and is kind of replaced over in here. Maybe it belongs here. Let's get on to the story of their offspring. Rebecca and Isaac have, what's their offspring? They have twins named what?
Esau and Jacob,
in that order. Except that when they're born, Esau's born first, but Jacob does what? He's got a hold of Esau's heel as Esau comes out, which is a picture of the relationship between the two. And Esau even quotes that later on when he's been schnookered a couple times by his brother, his younger brother. Only younger by a very short time, of course. Let's start with verse 27 of chapter 25. And the lads grew up, and Esau was a man skilled in hunting, a man of the field, and Jacob was a simple man, a dweller in tents. And Isaac loved Esau for the game that he brought him, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Doesn't say why, she just did. And Jacob prepared a stew, and Esau came from the field, and he was famished. And Esau said to Jacob, "Let me gulp down some of this red stuff, for I am famished." That's the language. It's very crude language. The word gulp is the word used for an animal eating its feed. And the literal, what he asked for is red. "Let me gulp this red. Therefore, is his name called Edom. We won't worry about that etymology or whatever it is. And Jacob said, "Sell now your birthright to me." What's the birthright? It's the right of the older son to the major share of the inheritance. And Esau said, "Look, I'm at the point of death, so why do I need a birthright?" And Jacob said, "Swear to me now." And he swore to him. And he sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew. And he ate and he drank. It's holden food. And he rose and he went off. And Esau spurned the birthright. So Jacob has tricked his brother out of one of the two things that he's going to get.
You know, we look down on Jacob because he did that. Say he's a shyster. What's that say about Esau and his respect for the birthright?
Exactly. There's not a whole lot to be said in his favor. He's very careless about something as valuable as that. He's kind of wrapped up in the immediate thing. He likes to hunt and likes to be out and do things out in the woods and doesn't plan ahead, doesn't think ahead at all. Jacob is thinking ahead, as is Rebecca. Well, let's jump through chapter 27. 26 is some back and forth between Abraham and Isaac and Abimelech. And, we get to Isaac, the lad who had been bound, the eager bridegroom. Now he's an old man. And it happened when Isaac was old, chapter 27, that his eyes grew too bleary to see. And he called to Esau, his elder son, and said to him, "My son." And he said, "Here I am." And he said, "Look, I have grown old. I know not how soon I shall die. So now take up, pray, your gear, your quiver, and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt me some game. And make me a dish of the kind that I love, and bring it to me that I may eat, so that I may solemnly bless you before I die." And Rebekah was listening as Isaac spoke to Esau, his son. And Esau went off to the field to hunt game and to bring. And Rebekah said to Jacob, her son, "Look, I've heard your father speaking to Esau, your brother, saying, 'Bring me some game, make me a dish that I may eat, and I shall bless you in the Lord's presence before I die.' So now, my son, listen to my voice, to what I command you. Go, hurry, pray to the flock, and fetch from there two choice kids, that I may make them into a dish for your father of the kind he loves. And you shall bring it to your father, and he shall eat, so that he may bless you before he dies." And her haste is well borne out, as we see. And Jacob said to Rebekah's mother, "Look, Esau, my brother, is a hairy man, and I am a smooth-skinned man." Remember Beyond the Fringe? He used to do a little thing on the road. "My brother is an hairy man, and I am a smooth-skinned man." The guy preaches a sermon on that text. "But what if my father feels me, and I seem a cheat to him, and bring on myself a curse and not a blessing?" And his mother said, "Upon me your curse, my son." She's very forceful. "I'll take it. Just listen to my voice and go fetch them for me." And he went and he fetched and he brought to his mother. And his mother made a dish of the kind his father loved. She knew how to spice a goat to make it taste like venison. And Rebekah took the garments of Esau, her elder son, the finery that was with her in the house, and put them on Jacob, her younger son. And the skins of the kids she put on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck. And she placed the dish and the bread she had made in the hand of Jacob, her son. So she arranges everything, just gives it to him, tells him what to do, tricks him up as Esau. And he came to his father and said, "Father." And he said, "Here I am. Who are you, my son?" And Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you have spoken to me. Rise, pray, sit up, and eat of my game, so that you may solemnly bless me." And Isaac said to his son, "How is it you found it this soon, my son?" "Because the Lord your God gave me good luck." And Isaac said to Jacob, "Come close, pray, that I may feel you, my son, whether you are my son Esau or not." He's pretty suspicious, isn't he? And Jacob came close to Isaac, his father, and he felt him, and he said, "The voice is the voice of Jacob, and the hands are Esau's hands." But he did not recognize him, for his hands were like Esau's hands, hairy. And he blessed him. And he said, "Are you my son Esau?" He said, "I am." And he said, "Serve me that I may eat of the game of my son, so that I may solemnly bless you." And he served him, and he ate, and he brought him wine, and he drank. That wasn't a bad idea, to throw him some wine, too. And Isaac, his father, said to him, "Come close, pray, and kiss me, my son." Why does he want to do that? He wants to smell him. He came close and kissed him, and he smelled his garments. And he blessed him. him and said, "See, the smell of my son is like the smell of the field that the Lord has blessed." Lots of manure, probably. "May God grant you from the dew of the heavens and the fat of the earth. May people serve you and nations bow before you. Be overlord to your brothers. May your mother's son bow before you. Those who curse you, be cursed. And those who bless you, blessed." So was Rebecca right? Who got the curse? Not Jacob, but those who curse him are cursed. And it happened as soon as Isaac finished blessing Jacob, and Jacob barely had left the presence of Isaac, his father, that Esau, his brother, came back from the hunt. And he too made a dish and brought it to his father. And he said to his father, "Let my father rise and eat of the game of his son, so that you may solemnly bless me." And his father, Isaac, said, "Who are you?" He said, I'm your son, your firstborn, Esau." And Isaac was seized with a very great trembling, and he said, "Who is it then who caught game and brought it to me, and I ate everything before you came and blessed him? Now, blessed he stays." When Esau heard his father's words, he cried out with a great and very bitter outcry, and he said to his father, "Bless me too, father." Three times he's going to say this. And he said, "Your brother has come in deceit and has taken your blessing." And he said, "What's his name, Jacob, that he should trip me now twice by the heels? My birthright he took, and look, now he's taken my blessing." And he said, "Have you not kept back a blessing for me?" And Isaac answered and said to Esau, "Look, I made him overlord to you and all his brothers. I gave him as slaves, and with grain and wine I endowed him. For you then, what can I do, my son?" And Esau said to his father now the third time, "Do you have but one blessing, my father? Bless me too, father." And Esau raised his voice and he wept, this strong outdoorsman. And Isaac his father answered and said to him, "Look, from the fat of the earth be your dwelling. From the dew of the heavens above, by your sword shall you live. And your brother you will serve. And when you rebel, you shall break off his yoke from your neck." And Esau seethed with resentment against Jacob over the blessing his father had blessed him, and said in his heart, "As soon as the time for mourning my father comes round, I will kill Jacob, my brother." Well, Rebekah hears about this and says, "Look, get out of here, and you need a wife anyhow. So go to the home of my brother Laban. And I can explain to your father this is nothing to do with Esau. This is for fetching a wife. Why should I be reft of you both on one day?" she says. And besides, she says, she says to Isaac in verse 46, "I loathe my wife because of the Hittite women. If Jacob takes a wife from Hittite women like these, from the native girls, what good to me is life?" She's a bit dramatic when she needs to be. And we find out later on that Esau has taken Hittite women as wife, and Rebekah can't stand him. So Isaac sends Jacob in chapter 28 to go to Rebekah's family. From there, find a wife from the daughters of Laban, which is... this is the original blessing of Abraham repeated. "May El Shaddai bless you and make you fruitful and multiply, so you become an assembly of peoples. And may he grant you the blessing of Abraham to you and your seed as well, that you may take possession of the land of your sojournings, which God granted to Abraham." So Isaac really blesses Jacob again with the original blessing that was given to Abraham, Isaac's father. So off he goes. Well, something wonderful happens on his journey there in chapter 28, verse 10. "He came upon a certain place and stopped there for the night, and he took one of the stones of the place and put it at his head and lay down in that place, and he dreamed, and look, a ramp," Alter's translation, "a ramp, not a ladder. We are climbing Jacob's ziggurat." That's the idea that he thinks is here. was set against the ground, with its top reaching the heavens, and look, messengers of God were going up and coming down on it. And look, the Lord was poised over him. And he said, I, the Lord, am the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, to you I will give it, and to your seed. And your seed shall be like the dust of the earth. You shall burst forth to the west and the east and the north and the south, and all the clans of the earth shall be blessed through you and through your seed. And as an extra promise now for Jacob, and look, I am with you, and I will guard you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. Remember that promise, that he will go with him and guard him and bring him back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done that which I have spoken to you. And Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, indeed, the Lord is in this place, and I did not know. And he was afraid, and he said, how fearsome is this place? This can be but the house of God, and this is the gate of the heavens. So he set up a pillar, called the place Beth El, that is, house of God. And Jacob makes a vow too, which is somewhat conditioned. Jacob's way. If the Lord, verse 20, if the Lord God be with me and guard me on this way that I am going, and give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, and I return safely to my father's house, then the Lord will be my God. Now, some scholars have said that's not as conditional as it sounds, so you can take that as you will. And this stone that I set as a pillar will be a house of God, and everything that you give me, I will surely tithe it to you. So here comes the tithe, which we have from Abraham, by the way. Remember, he tithes to Melchizedek. Well, where do you suppose Jacob finds himself when he gets to the land of the Easterners? At a well. And of course, there he meets Rachel. In this case, the watering is not done by Rachel. It's Jacob who surprises you with his strength. He rolls away the stone from the mouth of the well that usually a group of shepherds roll away. I guess he wants to impress his girl, and he gets the strength he needs. He's been eating powder milks, I suppose. He's going to do what needs to be done. And he rolls away the stone and waters her sheep. And so she takes him home to her father. And Laban greets him warmly. Indeed, you are my bone and my flesh. Verse 14. Well, he stays for a month, and apparently he's working for him, helping with the flocks and all. Laban says to Jacob, because you're my kin, should you serve me for nothing? Tell me what your wages should be. And Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, the name of the younger, Rachel. And Leah's eyes were, Alter says, tender. What do your translations have?
Lovely.
Weak, delicate, lovely, tender. There's something peculiar about Leah's eyes, good or bad, but she somehow doesn't please Jacob like Rachel does. Rachel was comely in features. Maybe she had a better figure, I don't know. And comely to look at. And Jacob loved Rachel. And he said, I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter. It's very clear which one he wants. Well, you know what happens. He works 7 years. They have a big wedding feast. The bride is not to be seen. And in the darkness of the night in the tent, a veiled woman comes and lies with Jacob. And all night he cries, according to the old Midrash, Rachel, Rachel. And she says, here I am. In the morning he wakes up, and who is it? It's Leah. Hey! He's furious. And what is this you have done to me? He says to Laban. Was it not for Rachel that I served you? And why have you deceived me? And Laban said, well, it is not done thus in our place. Do you
No big deal.
Finish out the bridal week of this one, and we shall give you the other as well for the service you render me for still another 7 years. And so Jacob did. So he gets Rachel, you know, soon afterwards. And each of them gets the slave girl or servant girl along with her. Rachel has Bilhah, and Leah has Zilpah. And the Lord, verse 31, saw Leah was despised, and he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. And Leah conceived and bore a son and called his name Reuben, for she said, "Yes, the Lord has seen my suffering, for now my husband will love me." And she conceived again and bore a son, and she said, "Yes, the Lord has heard I was despised, and he has given me this one too." And she called his name Simeon. The boys' names are a commentary on this contest with Rachel. And she conceived again and bore a son, and she said, "This time at last my husband will join me, for I have borne him three sons. Therefore is his name called Levi." And she conceived again and bore a son, and she said, "This time I sing praise to the Lord." Therefore she called his name Judah. These explanations of the names are rather free plays on the names. They're not precise translations of them.
Apparently and she wasn't completely despised by Jacob because she kept getting pregnant. So he kept coming back for more. There must have been something
complete.
There with those lovely eyes or something.
Yeah, there was something.
Yeah.
And she ceased bearing children. So she's had four. Chapter 30. And Rachel saw that she had borne no children to Jacob. She's kind of a little like Rebecca, her mother-in-law. I don't know if she's this way by nature or she's just observing her mother-in-law, to whom Jacob is very attached. And Rachel saw she had borne no children to Jacob, and Rachel was jealous of her sister, and she said to Jacob, "Give me sons, for if you don't, I'm a dead woman." And Jacob was incensed with Rachel, and he said, "Am I instead of God, who has denied you the fruit of the womb?" You think of someplace farther along the line? Rachel's son says the same thing many years later in Egypt. When his brothers discover that the brother they had sold as a slave, Joseph, is now lord of Egypt and has him in the palm of his hand, can do whatever he likes with them, and they're afraid that he's going to now punish them, kill them, or whatever, for what they've done to him. And what does Joseph say? "Am I in the place of God?" And she said, "Here's my slave girl, Bilhah. Come to bed with her, that she may give birth on my knees." What does that mean? That is, produce children that I will adopt, that will be my children, so that I too shall be built up through her. And she gave him Bilhah, her slave girl, as a wife, and Jacob came to bed with her. Jacob doesn't argue with any of these. And Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. And Rachel said, "God granted my cause. Yes, he heard my voice and he gave me a son." Therefore she called his name Dan. And Bilhah, Rachel's slave girl, conceived again and bore a second son to Jacob. And Rachel said, "In awesome grapplings, I have grappled with my sister. And yes, I won out." There's a big wrestling that's coming up tomorrow. And she called his name Naphtali. And Leah saw that she had ceased bearing children, and she took Zilpah, her slave girl, and gave her to Jacob as a wife. So they marshal all their resources in this contest. They bring in ringers. And
Jacob's a mere pawn.
Yeah. Poor Jacob. Don't you feel sorry for him?
Stuck for him.
And Zilpah, Leah's slave girl, bore Jacob a son. And Leah said, "Good luck has come." And she called his name Gad. And Zilpah, Leah's slave girl, bore a second son to Jacob. And Leah said, "What good fortune, for the girls have acclaimed me fortunate." And she called his name Asher. So it gets another little element in this struggle. Reuben went out. Who's Reuben?
First son.
That's Leah's first. Yeah, the oldest of the whole lot. Reuben went out during the wheat harvest and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to Leah, his mother. And Rachel said to Leah, "Give me, pray, some of the mandrakes of your son." And she said, "Is it not enough that you have taken my husband and now you would take the mandrakes of my son?" So she still feels that Rachel is the favored wife. Yeah. Then Rachel said, "Then let him lie with you tonight in return for the mandrakes of your son." And Jacob came from the field in the evening, and Leah went out to meet him and said, "With me you will come to bed, for I have clearly hired you with the mandrakes of my son." And he lay with her that
day. Doing what he's told.
Jacob is, very willing, apparently. So whatever the ladies want. And he lay with her that night. And God heard Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. So she's gotten going again after a hiatus. And Leah said, "God has given me my wages because I gave my slave girl to my husband." And she called his name Issachar. And Leah conceived again and bore a sixth son to Jacob. And Leah said, "God has granted me a goodly gift. This time my husband will exalt me, for I have borne him six sons." There's always that hope, isn't there, with Leah? Maybe now he'll really love me because of what I have done for him. And she called his name Zebulun. And afterwards she bore a daughter, and she called her name Dinah. But there's no wordplay, there's no explanation of what Dinah is supposed to mean.
Is there anything that you can make of the fact that Jacob, he seems to have no input into the naming of the children? It's all...
Yeah, it's interesting. It's the women that are naming them.
It's the women that are
naming
them. Well, not the slave women either. It's Rachel and Leah.
Rachel and Leah, they name the children of their girls. Well, Rachel is not forgotten in this context. Verse 22, God remembered Rachel.
Oh yeah, Rachel.
And God heard her, and he opened her womb. And she conceived and bore a son, and she said, "God has taken away my shame." And she called his name Joseph, which is to say, "May the Lord add me another son." Remember what she said to Jacob? "Give me sons, or I will die." Sons, plural. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that she should say, connect death with sons, plural, because it's in the giving birth to the second son later on, Benjamin, that she, in fact, dies. Well, at this point, Rachel... maybe that's a good place to stop. Comments on this. This is quite a wild story, isn't it? Now, in all of this, this contest between Rachel and Leah, in which Jacob is just, he's sort of like the stud bull or something, he's just doing his job. He doesn't seem to be much engaged other than in the part that is necessary for him to be engaged in. But no decisions are being made by him at all. It's the women who are fighting it out. But in all of this kind of groungy business, if it looks that way too, or humorous, or whatever it is there some sign that God is at work in all this? Certainly the women are aware of that. They frequently name the children with reference to God. God has heard me. God has remembered me. That's part of the meaning of the names that they give the children. But what's happening here? What is being produced out of all this?
Israel
is being produced. Okay. Remember the promise to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Your seed will be as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sands of the sea. As the dust of the earth.
But it's the numbers.
And the number 12 is significant because these are the 12 fathers of the 12 tribes of Israel.
What I'm saying is the part of the promise that's about numbers, there's a promise that's about, lots of people. And then there's qualitative promises. And this is the setup here is not a great setup for quality.
Volume.
Got volume.
Lots of diversity.
Lots of diversity.
You got to do that because if they keep marrying their cousins, they're going to have trouble. So you got to have lots of brothers from lots
strong
of different
strong
wives
blood
so they can marry each other.
Right. There's four different wives involved here. So the cousin effect is attenuated somewhat.
Right.
Okay.
They weren't exactly young either.
I find it curious that in the midst of all of this deception and manipulation and apparent length of strength on Jacob's part, that God can still work. And that maybe God has chosen to work in the midst of all the deception, manipulation that's going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, we would not give any of these characters top recommendations for character references.
Abraham,
Yes.
Although he's got his weak points too, when he goes to Egypt and passes Sarah off as his sister.
Yeah.
Cause of that trouble.
Wants the Pharaoh have her so we can have grain.
But on the whole, he's pretty good. Yeah. But this Jacob is quite a customer.
And that's true today. God can work through anybody. But still, as individuals, our goal is not to be manipulative, deceptive.
Yeah. Through all this whole business, God's purposes are working out, and there, at the end of it all, you have these, the 12 tribes of the nation. You don't see it coming, but there it is at the end. Somebody else had something to say back here. Somebody spoke, we didn't quite hear what you were saying. I couldn't see who it was. Okay, we'll leave it then. Let's see, we got about four more minutes.
I was the person who earlier, but I did, something came to me, something you said. I always took Rebecca as being very deceitful. That story is a very deceitful story. But then today when we're talking about Esau selling the birthright, it didn't mean anything to him. Enough. He married a Hittite. Already there is a division or there's a weakening, quote, of a line from what you had said. And there are a couple other things, too. And so all of a sudden, I'm not thinking deceit anymore. I'm thinking that, what was the word you used? Preservation. And that maybe this, what would appear as deceit or what was deceitful, really was necessary. And you think in terms of today, we have weeks on, week, whatever it is, you know, that we would maybe would cultivate one of our other children to be a leader or something like that if we see real weakness in one and strength in another, like that. Maybe that's somewhat of what was going on here, too. I have a new respect, a different respect.
When you talk about preservation, it's certainly borne out when the people finally come after the sojourn in Egypt, where they become very numerous, and then they come out through great signs and wonders and wander in the wilderness, they finally come into the promised land. They're going to actually possess it now as a nation. And what is the one of the biggest commands that they are given? Do not intermarry with the local women because they will lead you astray. You'll start worshiping their gods. And so that's already there with Esau and his Hittite wives.
Jonathan?
Yeah.
Up above. Is there any significance that it looks like the offspring of the slaves for Rachel and Leah were honored as part of the covenant? But when Abraham and Sarah chose that option, the offspring there were not so well greatly received.
Why is that? I've got a notion, but anybody else respond to that? That's Hagar and Ishmael he's talking about. Mm-hmm. Hagar has his trial son, Ishmael, but God says, no, that's not the one. The promise doesn't go through Ishmael, although there's a place for him, but not in the main line that he's planning. Well, the whole story of Abraham was a story of impossibilities. And there's not going to be any human help along the way. Very different from Jacob and his wives and their girl, slave women. So there's nothing that Abraham and Sarah can do, you know, on the side to make God's promise come true. God is sovereignly going to make this happen in a miraculous way. I think maybe that's why it's confined to this one, Isaac. And also the whole sacrifice thing doesn't have that terrible dissonance and contradiction to it unless that's the sole vehicle of the promise. So That's the only thing I can think of, but... Well, we've come up to 10 o'clock. Next time, we'll do a quick look at Jacob's departure with all of his family, which is beginning to get quite numerous, and flocks and herds. But he has to do some wrestling with Laban to get his pay for all his work. And then he heads for home, where he hears along the way that his brother Esau is coming to meet him with 400 men. In what spirit is Esau coming to meet him, is the question. And it's in that mood that he divides up all his people, tries to, somebody maybe will survive if he attacks us, and goes alone back across the river and meets someone there, which is where I thought we left off last time, but is where we do leave off today. And that's where we'll pick up wrestling with the stranger tomorrow. Go in peace and serve the Lord.
Thank you. Thank you.